Hiya, and welcome back to another solo episode with me. Weekly check-in with me, things have been like, well, I don't know, stable for this time. I'll probably talk about seasonal change for a lot. In fact, next week's episode is another solo, I know, out of order, but another solo with me on seasonal change. I sort of thought along that I would do that with a specialist, and then I sort of had an epiphany yesterday and I was like, actually, it'd probably be really good from my perspective or as a solo episode because I'm able to really talk about my experience, the things that have helped, what I've used and what I currently am using, as well as over the last 10 years doing it, I get educated each time. And some of it is a repeat or a rehash of the whole like sort of seasonal change element and what goes into it, but then other stuff are brand new information that has been incredibly helpful. So yeah, that'll be next week, and again, it's season change, and that kind of happens around March, April, and then again in September, October. So my sleep's been off. I've been super tired during the day and first thing in the morning. Like normally I'm kind of the person that's a morning person, and particularly an early morning person. Like I love those first few hours, but at the moment I've only been able to really wake up and make a coffee. If my stomach wants to stomach a coffee, sometimes it does in the morning, and sit and watch some YouTube, which is fine. Like I just need to baby steps, and I do it every time in season change. And I've got a lot of DIY and home improvement and miniature modeling and all sorts of nerdy enjoyment things that I like watching lined up. So it's a nice way to start the day, but it's also not how I normally start the day, I guess. I'm quite a productive individual. Sometimes, like a couple of days ago, I did start quite productive, and I did a number of notes and emails and things like that. So I was really pleased with that. But yeah, and I guess like part of that tiredness and lethargy and sort of fatigue comes the anxiety of like, I haven't done much. I've done too much. Am I nearing into manic? How long is this going to last? Have I been tracking well enough? Am I improving? All of that sort of stuff, which you get really sort of in your head about. Yeah. So that's a whole thing. At work, I've got a lot on, all positive, like incredibly positive. I'm really excited about what's already happened this year and also what's sort of planned to happen this year. And like I said, I've never been one to plan forward multiple years, but this has been a year that's signing on to things and being a chief investigator on projects. I've had to sort of really be like, yeah, I'm here for that length of time, or I'm excited to be here for that length of time. I'm going to plan to be here for that length of time. So some of them have been challenging. I've been writing an opinion piece most recently that, no kidding, when I say I've written it like 6 or 7 times, I mean, I've written it 6 or 7 times. It's just under 1,000 words, roughly, I think like 700, maybe 750. And I've written it that many times because I just haven't been able to get my thoughts onto paper and sort of like organize my thoughts and write them in a way that is compelling for an opinion piece, obviously, whilst referencing research that I've been involved in and that are core to this piece. Yeah, if you want me to share it when it's published, I'll share it. I think it'll be a really good one. Actually, I probably will share it because it will link in with an episode coming up with Dr. Frank Iofino on data and how we can use data to maintain and manage and give insight to our well-being and our mental health trajectory, and particularly our trajectory in wellness and remission, or stable remission for some of us. So yeah, let's jump into the episode on esketamine and why I'm taking it, what it does, how it works, and my experience with it all. So June last year, I think midway through last year, June, my psychiatrist, things just weren't getting better. And I felt like I had, and I actually had sort of deteriorated, to use an official term that I'm actually personally, I'm okay with. I know a lot of people aren't okay with it, but for me, working in the mental health space, we are I guess the bone structure is a clinical medical model. And so there's the semantics of it can be quite austere or really like quite rigid and have no personability to them and can be triggering for some people if they've had a really horrible response or experience with the use of it. And so that's kind of like the bones of it. And then the meaty, muscly part of it is our experience, and that kind of weaves in between. And so some people like to call it ill health, or generally I think it's best to call it ill health unless you're talking about it in this level, but, or this sort of circumstance. But my mental health disorders took a real sort of hit. I think they were on a slow decline, so it sort of, I didn't really notice it. So early intervention sort of, yeah, was a bit off in that sense, or I didn't intervene early enough. So basically, in June last year, my psychiatrist said, look, we're one of 150, I believe it was, clinical setting practices that have been chosen or have been successful in doing the clinical trial of the drug esketamine and its use in depressive disorders, specifically treatment-resistant depression, so TRD. And I've got that, but also some complex mood disorders and a few other sort of sub-depressive disorders. And esketamine, it sounds like the word ketamine because it is ketamine. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. But so I've been doing this 16-week, well, I did this 16-week trial. And when you're part of the clinical trial, you then can stay within that program or that accessibility and use of it. So this clinical trial is to gain final approval from the PBS in Australia, which is the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. And they sort of, they approve a drug for clinical use and interventions. And so this is the final stage of the PBS being approved. And they think it'll take, you know, it'll be within the next 12, 18 months that it'll be sort of officially approved, which is incredible. And its use of it is in varying depressive disorders and enabled to not target the remission of depression, but a complete remission of the depression, but what's called a stable remission where things are manageable and they sort of elevate that deterioration to something where you can use other interventions or support systems to then sort of enable a bit more of a remission or illness trajectory that's a bit more copable or manageable. So it's, the drug has already been approved by the MBS, the Medicare Benefit Scheme. So the drug itself is actually free or it's been covered, but the clinical time and the renting of the clinical space and the clinician's time is what you pay for. And I think that's a setback of like maybe $200+, which is, for me, it's weekly. And at one point it was bi-weekly. And that's a huge financial commitment, and it's been quite hard to do that. But if you're anything like me and there's a slither of hope or a possibility or a strong chance even to sort of put out more in any area of life in order to get that or get to that, then absolutely doing it, particularly when it comes to health. So yeah, once it's approved by the PBS, just like the Medicare Benefits Scheme or the MBS, it will therefore be made more accessible and more clinics can then practice it and implement it for their patients, and it'll be more affordable. So I don't know what that affordability will look like, but it'll be more affordable and more accessible for people. And I think that'll be an incredible thing because I've found it revolutionary in my mental health. The trial lasts for 16 weeks. So the first 4 weeks of the trial, you're doing it, like I said, bi-weekly. So for me, that was on a Tuesday and a Thursday. And you've got to, you have a day or so apart like I did. I'm not sure why, but that's just generally how it works out. So the first 4 weeks is that. And then you have a clinical checkup or assessment. And then the next 4 weeks you move to once weekly. And then after that 4 weeks, you have another clinical assessment and you either work out for the following 8 weeks with a 4 week clinical assessment in between after 4 weeks of the 8 weeks. You either move to once fortnightly or you remain at once weekly. And for me, I remained at once weekly. And so I've been doing it for the past 9-ish months. And yeah, like I said, I've been, I found it revolutionary. I have, I guess, the overarching sort of disorder or diagnosis that I have is a complex mood disorder, which sort of entails things like suicidal ideation, which is separate to mental health, but it's sort of like circadian rhythm disorders is quite synonymous, which comes with its own worthlessness and hopelessness and all of that. Sleep and energy is a thing. And that kind of also, like I said, circadian rhythm disorders also, like with seasonal change, it's a whole incestuous situation with me. and then like quite heavily for me is the disassociation and the numbness from general life and emotions or feelings or events or people. And then, like I said, I've been unrespondent to medications, essentially. So I fall also under the treatment-resistant depression. So, yeah, I unfortunately met the classifications of unwell enough or at a low enough level in my mental health disorders to be accepted into the program or to meet the criteria, requirements, whatever you want to use. So esketamine, like I said, sounds an awful lot like the drug ketamine. And that's because it's a derivative of ketamine, which if you're like me, you've only ever heard it in the recreational use, parties and things like that. Or you watch medical shows and you hear it as an anesthetic for acute pain at significant doses for acute pain. You'll hear them be like, give them so-and-so ounces or milligrams of ketamine stat. Probably they don't say stat, but you know. And so particularly with the sort of the party drug, recreational drug side of things, this often comes varying connotations. And in my mind, they were quite negative. So I was a little bit prejudiced toward it. But then when I sort of was starting to understand it, and part of like my master's and the fundamental neuroscience, neurobiology element that I've just recently been doing. Oh, that's been tough. And I sat an exam on Friday last week about it. And full transparency, I couldn't answer two of the questions. I feel like I learned backwards. So some of you might be the same. I learn from like big picture to small, but very much from a medical science perspective, they go small picture big. And so for me, it takes a while to actually, and also takes sort of things like this for me to actually understand the process and how it works, et cetera. So going back, most chemicals or drugs within our system, chemicals in this case, have a pair of mirror image molecules, which means one's stronger and one's weaker. So kind of like your right and left hand. Neither of those molecules, the stronger and the weaker, are any better or greater than the other. They just perform different tasks and different things. So esketamine is the purest form of ketamine. It's the stronger of the two. And the way it works is like, it's like a cheerleader for a football team. It keeps the morale of our neurotransmitters, which are the sort of the message carriers, to different parts of our brain and body. It keeps those messages sending and those neurotransmitters working and working frequently and carrying those messages to those varying parts of our brain. And esketamine and its cheerleading capacity targets that functioning part, particularly within the part of our brain that controls and works on messages and memory and aging and so on. So it's really core, that functioning is really core to our well-being. It enables us to complete tasks and essentially engage in a healthy lifestyle that aids the management and the increasing well-being overall. So the reason why it works in certain subtypes of depression and also other mental health disorders, and actually, funnily enough, they are looking at it from that functionality perspective in non-neurotypical brains or conditions like ADHD and ADD, etc. But there's a functional impairment, basically. The functionality of that is unstable, and it's not what the brain needs to work properly or function properly. So like I said, there's the inability to complete tasks. Things are a lot harder. You aren't totally able to engage in a healthy lifestyle, which, like I said, eventuates well-being. So that cheerleading role that I was talking about before that ketamine and specifically esketamine does is unstable. It's like instead of having 100 cheerleaders cheering the team on and really building up that morale and like a crowd, they've got like one or two. And so it's a little deflated. It still cheers on the occasional football team player, but not as many players and as excitable and energy producing as a crowd of cheerleading brilliant individuals. So yeah, they use esketamine in depressive disorders, like I said, to target that functioning impairment so that we can engage in things like those healthy elements of engagement are things like routine, waking up, going to bed, eating, etc., sleep. It helps in us attending and actually physically going to school or study, whatever that might look like, TAFE or university or college, work and so on. And part of that, separate but also linked, is the socializing, seeing people and then physical exercise and also general life organizing. So part of that, like waking up and making your bed or cleaning your apartment or house and taking the dog for a walk, those sorts of things that all in little ways contribute to us actually feeling better and coping with things and just essentially moving forward. So the dose is like a sub anesthetic dose. It's like a, I guess what you could call a medicinal dose. It's not hardcore like when it's used as an anesthetic in hospitals for pain. It's that sort of lower dose, so it doesn't sort of completely wipe you out. I've been asked a fair bit actually about the risks associated and if there are any, and particularly things like addiction and that style of thing. And like with any drug, there is obviously a slight addictive quality differing again with different drugs. But the makeup of esketamine or ketamine as well is different to things like alcohol and some other drugs that are more addictive. Like sugar and caffeine even. So really the only risks are blood pressure increases, and for individual people that could be quite a large amount. And so in the clinical setting, you have your blood pressure monitored just so that they can, you're maintaining a, you're within an appropriate or a well-balanced amount of increase. And for me, it's actually kind of okay. I naturally have quite low blood pressure and heartbeats per minute, to the point actually where my Apple Watch sleeping used to wake me up until it sort of got used to that. That's my thing. Wake me up because it thought I was dying, I guess. And it was like, are you okay? Your BPMs are below average, et cetera, et cetera. But another alongside the blood pressure is nausea, and that's kind of mitigated by not eating or drinking for a couple of hours prior, and then obviously tiredness as well. Like taking anything, you know, like a cold and flu or anything like that, you do feel tired. Anything that's kind of like a bit higher in medicinality or sort of intervention or impact, you do tend to feel tired. I mean, you're adding extra work for your body. Sort of going back to that nausea thing, it's administered in a certain way. And obviously, again, I want to keep stressing in a clinical setting because that's how I've experienced it. But also, too, that's the safest setting because there is the aided administration of the actual drug, but then there's also the monitoring for things like the blood pressure and nausea and things like that. And then also with prolonged use, the clinical monitoring is key, again, for those addictive qualities, to make sure that it's all at bay and running above board. And if need be, if that's the situation you end up in or an individual ends up in, they can then intervene. So it's, like I said, it's a sub-anesthetic dose and it's administered intranasally. So kind of like any of those antihistamine sprays that you spray up your nose that really like burn the lining of your nose if there's not any mucus on the lining of your nose. It does tend to burn, but momentarily. And it tastes foul when it sort of goes back down. You don't want it to go down the nasal passage down the back of your throat, but sometimes it does. Or for me, it has. I haven't really mastered the technique fully yet. I'm getting better. You've got to sort of push it like anything. But yeah, the clinician that sort of monitors and aids the administration is like, you've got to really follow through and really punch it. But yeah, and you've kind of got to direct it in a certain way in the nose. So, but first, actually, you've got to blow your nose. You really want to clear any of that mucus, any of that snot that's lining the inside of your nose, because you really want it to permeate those red blood cells, so it's then carried to the brain and oxygenated, et cetera, and get to that part that needs the functional ketamine or the ketamine to cheer it on. And so you blow your nose and you blow it as hard as you can and get as much out so that you've got that clean work slate. And then you angle it so that you can get like the angle perfect for shooting right up the nasal passage. And then whichever nostril, you sort of pull the skin away so that you can sort of open that nasal passage up as much as possible. And then afterwards you pinch your nose and I just started doing it as a demonstration, but obviously you can't see. You pinch your nose and you blow really hard, almost like as if you're trying to unblock or clear your ears, pop your ears, and you blow or create that pressure for like approximately 5 seconds. And what that does is inflates the red blood cells again, so that because it's going through the skin onto those red blood cells, you really want to give it the best opportunity to be absorbed and have those red blood cells saturated. Then another part to that is just a big deep breath in. And what that does is does the same thing, oxygenates them, gives them that energy to keep going. So that's kind of like the way it happens, and you kind of tilt your head varying sort of ways to try and keep the liquid in there and permeate as long as it can. And like I said, I haven't probably mastered it. Sometimes it goes down the back of my throat and it's foul, and sometimes it comes out the front a little bit. But yeah, you sort of tilt your head in varying ways to sort of make sure it's there. You do that for every dose, and I take 3 doses, so that's 6 individual nostrils. And between each dose, so between each sort of set of nostrils, you wait 5 minutes for it to permeate, so you're not sort of got a buildup of liquid, which then, you know, will run away. You want to get as much absorption of that drug. So you wait 5 minutes in between. And for me, I really start to experience it, or I can really feel the hit midway between the second and the third dose. My sight goes blurry. The barrier of the filter between my thoughts and what I actually say lowers a lot. And then even at the half mark, when they come in and check your blood pressure, it's even worse. and my clinician often comes in at the halfway mark and goes, "Mate, you are out of it. You're enjoying it." Because I have this weird, from what I've seen in the photos, I had this weird like smirk of like absolutely rolling in it. So withdrawn and so just, I don't know, if you've ever seen a dog just like smiling from a scratch or a meal or whatever, and they are just in heaven, that's picture that. Although, like I said before, I will put up a carousel of images on my social media because I, in transparency, I think it's funny, but I, you know, it's also the experience. It's part of the whole experience. And for me, visuals are really helpful. And so I've kind of done that like casual documentation of it for eventual viewers to enjoy and have a bit of a fun laugh or humorous part about the mental health journey and interventions, because they're not always enjoyable or positive or anything like that. So for me, it's a really euphoric sense. And like I said, like, vision gets blurry. I'm used to blurry vision, but not that blurry. Like, I can't even read a text if it's like 5 centimeters or 5 meters, like, you know, 10 centimeters in front of me. Like, it's insane, the blurriness, even when wearing my glasses. So when I'm texting my mom, because you have to be picked up to pick me up, you are so inebriated. It's like you're overserved. So you can't drive, you can't make your way home alone, or it's not advised, and you obviously can't operate heavy machinery. But yeah, so you have to get someone to take you home, and for me, that's my mum. Thank you, mum. It's so wonderful that you are selflessly loving me in this way, and I know you wouldn't have it any other way. But when trying to text my mum that, like, I'm halfway through, I'm just finishing now, the texts don't make sense when I look back at them. They are just absolute random letters, because I've just been pounding that keyboard trying to use muscle memory with big thumbs. Yeah, so it's completely euphoric, and you're sort of disassociated both like mentally and physically, and that disassociation and euphoric feeling means that physically you don't feel touch. Like, you're so still, and normally when you're lying down or even when you're in water, you can feel the friction and the weight of like your body against things or against the water or the furniture or whatever you're sort of experiencing, or even like limb on limb. You don't feel that at all. It is like you're honestly, it's like you're completely weightless, and you don't feel, you have no feeling. It's incredible. And depending on, you know, what visual you're experiencing, your body replicates it almost. So at one point I was experiencing like I was in this giant puffer vest, but it was like, it was weird. It was kind of like that. I don't know if you remember or you ever saw that. I think it was a music video for maybe Kid Cudi and Kanye. It was definitely Kanye, because then I remember Kimye recreated it with their kids for Halloween, where they're like that box suit, almost like a Minecraft character. And it's kind of, I had a vision of being, and it felt like I was like that. But then it's almost like in WALL-E, those obese people where their bones sort of separated because there was so much fat around them, that yeah, it felt like my whole body expanded. It was so surreal. And other times I've been like stretched out, and really, really feels like it's so convincing. You feel like you are actually being stretched. Or like another one, I was like an octopus and liquid and slipping through a drain or something, or some hole. I can't remember. And I felt like I had turned to liquid. I've never experienced those feelings, obviously, but replicates it in just this absolutely convincing, real way. So there's that distortion and that euphoricness. You, like I said, you were completely inebriated. And one of the things that it does is it amplifies whatever emotion or mindset that you're in. And so you really want to be in the best mindset, so the most positive or the most sort of like stable mindset to enter a K-hole, as I call it, or as it's casually called. Actually, in my diary, and I refer to it at work and also casually, Special K. Not the Special K cereal, but like Special K, recreational. And it kind of, I did that at the beginning to sort of kind of normalize it, and the fears or nervousness that I had against it, it kind of made it a bit more palatable and a bit less daunting. Like it was an experience that I was going into fully because I didn't really know what to expect totally. I've never done it recreationally, never done drugs recreationally. So yeah, it was good in that sense. And yeah, it made it that bit more approachable, or I could stomach it that bit more than, you know, esketamine. It was less medical terminology, like I was sort of saying before. It was my own experience owning it. Yeah, so one of the first ones that I remember of, like, the visuals were insane. So, oh, sorry, I was saying about the mindset. I'll jump back to the visuals in a second. But the mindset, so Adele is Strictly, or anyone who is sort of like piano ballad, very emotional breakup songs, are prohibited because they will induce that. Like, you can't control your mindset. Once you're in it, you're in it. And that's why they want you in the most positive, not because it'll necessarily affect the functionality perspective, but because you'll just have a really hard time. And so you listen to positive music to keep you going in that sense. Because one time, I've only had it once, my friend who's going through it started just a little bit early. So it was kind of good to see her and sort of going through it, you know, a week or two ahead of me. I was sobbing. And if you know me, I don't cry. I can't cry. The saddest news, can't cry. My grandfather died, couldn't cry. My cat died, couldn't cry. Really sad shows, can't cry. But this session, I sobbed. I think I took a photo. Well, yeah, I took a photo of that. So yeah, you've got to be in a good mindset for it, but it doesn't affect the actual medical intervention. It's still sort of builds up those cheerleaders and hires those new cheerleaders to cheer those neurotransmitters on, pass those messages through. But yeah, the visuals are insane. If you've ever seen how they used to do animation, and I guess they still do it, but just in a more digital sense, they used to sketch out every single movement, like even the minute, and then the pages would flip through a computer, like a machine, and it'd film it, and then, you know, they could build up on it. The one that I'm thinking of is like Tinkerbell and Snow White, and also Mickey Mouse. So like those ones way back then. I've had a whole session where what I was experiencing was that. I had a really weird session where I was Googling. I went on my phone and Googled I Googled how to access the black market and how to get a false identity and all sorts of things. It was a really weird trip. But then one of the first ones that I remember having, it was a combination between a lava lamp and, I think they redid it just recently with Harry Styles when he sort of did the partnership with Apple Music. But when they released the Apple iPod way back, like mid 2000s, maybe it was like 2008 or 9, no, 2000, anyways, somewhere around there, 2007 maybe, they had those like duotone, high contrast duotone clashing color people with the white iPod, with the white headphones, and it was iconic. And then they'd sort of, in a very 70s graphic sort of, and I guess those graphics in the 70s were created because of these sorts of trips. It's almost like the person was replicated and sort of spiraled, and yeah, very psychedelic sort of patterns and designs and movements. So really, really cool. And as a creative person, absolutely inspiring in a sense. Like I often come away with really interesting sort of ideas or understandings, I guess, or new points of view on things. Like I said, that's because I get into a good headspace. And as a creative, I'd love to sort of work with someone to try and replicate these visuals purely from sort of what to expect perspective, because I think that they are, I just think they're beautiful. But also, like, if you're going to be doing it clinically, that this is what to expect, and sort of lowers that anxiety or that anxiousness about doing it for the first time. But yeah, that's kind of like what happens during and then and post. You're just, I'm tired. I want to have something to eat because you can't eat 2 hours before or drink. I want to have something to eat, something, normally something savory, not often something sweet personally, and just watch comedy, sitcoms, and sleep. One of my favorite ones most recently, actually, that I've really, really enjoyed is, oh my gosh, it's just slipped my mind, but I sent it to my family. So in my family chat. So I'm just going to look it up quickly. It's called Party Down. Hilarious show about like these cater waiters. It's kind of come back. It was in 2009 before, and then it's come back. It's got people like Jane Lynch and Adam Scott and Lizzie Kaplan. Love her. Megan Mullally, who was Karen Walker in Will and Grace. Anyways, I love watching that. That's been really fun to watch because it's just enjoyable. And you kind of just want something easy. I did used to watch Game of Thrones and kind of added to the trip, got to experience it on a different level. But because you kind of absolutely wiped, it is a large commitment of time and energy. And so if you're like me and you have had it in the morning or you have it midday, it knocks out the whole day. So that's something to be aware of. Some of those smarter people have it later in the afternoon, so there's less of that sort of taking up of the day. But that's, I mean, I kind of like with the cost factor, if it is going to improve my experience and my trajectory, count me in. It is the smallest compensation. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at on that. Just before I finish, and again, if you want to know anything else, hit me up on socials or through that email address. I wanted to say like that there's sort of been three different experiences in sort of toward or trajectories toward stable remission. The first has been, it is sort of like steady improvement. So if you think about each of these as a graph, a simple graph, the first is like a straight sort of increasement over time. So like a 45 degree angle going up. And that's sort of like, that's been one of them. The second is what I've experienced where there's that it starts off going up like the first, but then it plateaus and it stays at an even level like horror and goes along for a bit, and then it picks up again and goes like that first one increases at that sort of 45 degree angle. And that's what I had. And when it sort of goes stagnant or plateaus at that point, I knew that was how I was explained, these were explained at the beginning, and so I knew that that was how it, one of them might possibly be. But I still became a little disheartened and a bit sort of, oh gosh, is this failing? My treatment resistant depression, even resistant to something hardcore like this. But then the improvement picked up again. I think it was just before Christmas. So that's the second kind. And then the third kind, which I really didn't want. And I'm so glad. And I, from my experience or my prejudice, I'm sorry if you experienced this and you're listening. It's a plateau. It's straight plateau. So there's nothing for a while. And then it's almost like a straight 90 degree increase. It's like instantaneous and that's great. But also like really, I would find that personally, I would find that disheartening and it'd be hard to stomach that. So they're the kind of three that you, or that they've been able to document from experience, or some of them have slightly differed, but from an average or a mean, that's kind of what they've sort of noted. And so, yeah, if you're doing it, if you've just started, or if you're looking at doing it when it becomes more accessible and affordable and available to you, wherever you might be or looking at going to from a clinical space, then I hope this episode has been a somewhat educational and sort of shedding a light on a intervention that is a bit avant-garde, I guess you could say. Like it's not what your regular SSRI or antidepressant or antipsychotic or mood stabilizer or DBT, CBT or those sorts of things. It's not that sort of along those realms, and particularly because it doesn't actually target the disorder itself, but targets the functional impairment, like I said before at the beginning of the episode, where it gets that excitability of those neurons and those neurotransmitters to then, by cheerleading them on, to then pass those messages and increase your ability to engage in a healthy, more rounded well-being, wellness lifestyle. And I found it incredibly revolutionary and life-saving, life-changing. I still experience sort of spats of incredibly low depression and really hard intrusive thoughts and strong suicidal ideation. That's just part of parcel of my mood disorder. There's actually a great episode which I'll link. I'll link a couple of papers that I found interesting and great, but I'll also link this episode from colleague and friend Professor Ian Hickey, who is the co-director of the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, who we work with at the podcast, but I also work with as a youth lived experience researcher there in my day job. And Ian and I served time together on the National Mental Health Commissioners and were booted at the same time. That's a kettle of worms, can of worms, kettle of fish. Anyways, yeah, so he and his friend and James O'Loughlin, who is a brilliant gentleman who has been a criminal lawyer in his past lives. He's a stand-up comedian or has been a stand-up comedian, and he's a radio show host and an author. And there's a book based off this podcast, Minding Your Mind, which is go out and buy it. Really wonderful. I'll link that as well. There was an episode most recently about the medicinal benefits in mental health about these kinds of drugs and their interventions. And it was really interesting. His approach is very much from the scientific side of things, so closer to what the beginning of this episode was about. But he does it in a real plain English way, similar to how I just did. And James O'Loughlin brilliantly asks those questions that sometimes maybe you might think they're inappropriate, but they are what we're all thinking. And he has a brilliant ability of unbashfully asking them because they're what we want to know. So I'll link that. But yeah, I really hope that this has been a beneficial episode for you. It's been beneficial for me to actually collect my thoughts and experiences on this, like I sort of spoke to before, that these episodes help me in that sense. And if you're listening from the board of the PBS going to convene and approve it, please approve it. The cost is, it's a privilege to be able to pay it. It sort of feels weird to say, but it's a cost that not everyone and a large majority of the population won't be able to pay or can't pay, even when they pass their Medicare threshold. It ended up, when I passed it end of last year, it was like $40 a session. Still a lot, but yeah. If you're on that board and you're listening, please, please, please approve it. Obviously, one plea from one person won't sort of change your mind, but, you know, this has been my experience and I've found it incredibly beneficial. So, yeah. And I also want to say thank you to my clinicians, my psychiatrist, my psychologist, my mental health nurse, my GP, for all sort of sustaining me and supporting me in this and helping me into the program or getting me into the program. The receptionist for dealing with me post session, they've been really wonderful. I'm sure there's been some humorous times with me trying to insert the chip of the card and pay and remember the PIN and all of that. A huge thank you to my family for putting up with me whilst being high, and particularly my mum. I know it's been hard for her to actually see, for her to pick up her son and see him in the state he's been in, he being me. We are very open, as I've said before, and it was, yeah, from a parent's perspective, it's just hard. I'm sure if any other parent has picked up their child overserved or wellied, that they have experienced a similar thing where you just don't like seeing your kids like that. Either it's upsetting or whatever. So yeah, thank you to you, Mum. And oh, and my work as well. They've been really, really, really affording to me and making that space for me to be able to do this. So couldn't do it without you, particularly you, Christine. Shout out to you. Yeah. Hope you've enjoyed this episode and I'll see you next week.